So cooperative, we have to quantify what we mean cooperative. It means two-state model. Two-state model for us, as so far from biology that we cannot really deal with other than toy models. So what we mean with cooperative is that So what we mean with cooperative is that it is a two-state transition. That means that when you have below a folding temperature, you are in the native state, and then you switch to the denature state, and they do that very sharply. There's a number you can put on this sharpness, which is called this. It's called this sharpness coefficient, Van't Hoff coefficient, introduced by Privalov. What it essentially is, this is kind of tedious experiment where you measure this here by looking at fractions in folded and unfolded proteins. You look at the spike of the heat capacity, and you look at the total integral over it. You essentially measure the height versus the width. For us, it means also that it's essentially when you are at the transition point that you are equally much in the denatured, and of course you are, and in the native and denatured state. It's an equal population, but there's nothing in between. So this Van't Hoff coefficient is essentially kind of given by the variance of the energy distribution divided by the difference between these two squared. And this number is measured by Privalov and others for a lot of proteins, and the number is typically very close to 4. If you know something about the variance of a distribution which is between 0 and 1, it can somehow not be larger than a quarter. It can be smaller, it can be a 12 if it's homogeneous, or if it's a Gaussian, it can be infinite. But you measure it very, very close to its limit, so it's very much two-state. So when one construct models for proteins and should believe anything in it, one has to at least reproduce something like this here, else one are already off. And so let's construct a model. This is a kind of universal model for everything we have heard until now of models. And the model is consisting of some variables, folding variables, that can be right or wrong. Then you use these folding variables. You have a number of them, and they play with each other and go to the folded state, which consists of a whole series of ones. The most simple of this type of model would be just taking the sum of this. That would, of course, have a native state, a ground state, where all is one. But it would be completely uncooperative. It would be complete minus one. Sorry, there's a minus lagging and a minus lagging. Yes. So this would be completely uncooperative, and it would correspond to a protein where everything flaps in and out all the time. On the other hand, it would actually fold very fast, as far as it was at all could fold, because each of them could go to the one state very fast. The other extreme is the golf course potential, where it's a product of the phi. And then the folding is 2 to the power of n, which is infinite, but it's extremely cooperative. So that's not good either. Well, it's good for the cooperative, but it's too slow. I is just a index running over all the possible matches between all the ground state matches in the protein. So for each native binding, you have a phi I, whether it occur or not. And phi I counts 1, phi I equal 1 when this native contact is formed. This is folding time. Well, it depends on how you. Yes. Yes, here? Here, that is 1. Oh, yeah, sorry. There should have been an N there. Yes, it should have been an N. I'm sorry. Yes, of course. It should have been an N. Yes. It's only over native contacts. That's kind of a simplification here, very much like the Gould model. Then you can do the DNA modeling that we heard about some weeks ago, which is a SIBO model, which means that you first fold one, then you fold the next, and then you fold the next, and so forth. This is also a fairly fast folder. The because you just zip one after the other. But it's not very cooperative. It's actually first order, but kind of marginal, because any state along this line is equally probable at the transition point, because they just balance each other. So you get alpha equal 12, which is not very good. Then you can do hairpins, like this here. And that means that you are starting to looking at some game here with some phis, which are product, and some of them are lagging. Essentially, all the one out there does not contribute with any energy, and the rest contributes with energy. So this here would have a barrier, a nucleation barrier. Okay. And it would start being cooperative. And that is a game of how big the barrier is contra how much energy is. OK, now I should really be fast. So what we are proposing is kind of generalizing this to whatever kind of combination of products of phis, according to which folds that demands which other folds getting folded. And to get some concrete example, we take the one where we just take one from each order, one of first order, one of second order, and one of third order. This is a class of models, which you can criticize for many reasons, but it's very easy to solve, even when the numbers you take here out is random. You can make a solution in the sample average solution. And what you essentially get out of this is that in the beginning, it folds quite easily. But after some time, there are suddenly stretches of saying you have to fold in one go, which is somehow making a barrier. So that's a kind of nucleation barrier. And the size of this nucleation barrier is going essentially as a number of folds here to the square root of n. That means that the system has an entropy barrier where the folding time is going like 2 to the square root of n. The square root in this model is because you put in 1 here, 2 here, 3 here, 4 here, 5. So when you go I steps down, you have in total put I squared numbers in. And when I squared numbers, when you put them in random, when they become of order n, then you have nearly filled out everything. So you have actually kind of nearly folded all your variables. And after that, then you are when you put in some more numbers down here, they would mostly be shadowed by the ones you have already filled in. That means, for example, this one here, when I fold this one, it's quite easy because these two are already folded. So there's only one here. It goes very fast. This is a nucleation barrier for this one. This one is very easy because these two are already folded, so it's only one here. So this here shadows already. So this is only one. And so you. Yes. No, it's absolutely the highest. Yes. it is actually correct. But when you have so here you have put at this point here you have gone 4 steps down. You have 1, 2, 3, 4. So you have in total put 4 times 4 half. You have put in something of order I squared crosses in. And apart from the shadow, yes. Yeah. Yes. And then it gets, that means that the total number until step I is going like I squared. But like this number squared. So here, at this point, I have filled out 4 squared clauses.
The random deviation
yes.
from the linear
row. Yeah, there's some deviation from the linear, yes. Okay. It's. Yeah, it's not, this is really an average of how the typical behavior is. Some of the members of the sample would have a somewhat smaller, some would have a somewhat larger.
So you actually don't
I would consider in the entropy puzzle there would be a walk. Okay, yes. Due to this entropy barrier, you actually get alpha equal 4. You get a sharp transition. But there's some feature of this sharp transition that you can actually address, because this is due to an entropy barrier. That means when I change the temperature, which you can do like this here, so you have the at low energy, zero temperature, you always roll down here, like this here. Now you add some temperature, then the entropy counts more. It gets more difficult to fold. So it gets like this here. You add more temperature, and then the barrier gets higher because you weight the entropy more. So there is some critical temperature, which this is your melting temperature, where you have a huge barrier. You had a nice two-state system with an entropic barrier in between. But below this, there's some kind of kinetic temperature, which is where things begin to be difficult to fold. And it even lower it just rolls down. Whether this is possible to see or not in experiment, well, that depends essentially on something like this here. You have a folding time and a temperature. And folding time in this model here, when at all the small temperatures, it would be somehow constant, just rolling downhill. At some point, it will take off and become very, very slow. Now, this model was somewhat stupid because I didn't have non-native contacts. I didn't have any barriers. So of course, when you go to low temperatures, you start feeling barriers. So you actually have something that goes up there. So that's one feature of having entropy barriers, that you actually get a slowing down before your melting point. And just something I wanted to point out, because that was other models around with entropy barriers, the Go model, for example. Okay, second feature of the model, or extension you can do, is you can start playing with water, which is actually what I like to emphasize. So it's very simple. Now you have an extremely simple model, and you can solve it and whatever. You have a folded state, but you also could have an unfolded state. Well, here you have a, with phi equal 1, it's folded. When phi equals 1, then water is free around the protein. So if phi equal 1, then this is 0. So then I have a water variable here. What I mean with free is that if this water, when it's in contact with the protein, somehow has discrete energy levels, like here, then when it's not in contact with the protein, it is floating freely. That means that all these levels is completely entropic. They collapse and just give entropy. And well, the reason I have an energy ladder here, it's not completely arbitrary, it's because water has a constant heat capacity. So that you model with an energy ladder. And you actually, if you go into details and the number of steps in this energy ladder, you must, well, go to see what happened with hydrophobic forces at high temperatures. So as a result, you get a free energy for this type of model per monomer, which is looking something like this here. So when this here is when this energy, attractive energy between the hydrophobic or the inside of the protein and the water is sufficiently attractive, you become unstable at low temperature and you unfold. At this intermediate region, your entropy, it somehow costs too much in entropy to keep your water frozen down here. You can access all the states by melting the by freezing the protein, and then here you melt as usual. So yeah. Okay, that was a little bit about how we look at cold unfolding. Now I do the opposite. This was a little bit model. Then we go to some experiment, which is somehow looking at the whole thing from the opposite end. And this is an experiment done by some local biologists. It's related to the heat shock. So it's really a big jump. We go from now from proteins up to something on the cellular level. And you can take a cell, an E. coli cell, at some temperature and shift it to some other temperature. And then you can measure what happened. And what you especially can measure is the expression of chaperones. And in this study, we measure one particular chaperone, DNAK. It's not any DNA. Sorry, it should not have been big NA. It's always small for biologists. So you can measure the rate of DNAK expression as function of time. And you can normalize this with what it is at time equals 0. So you have your E. coli culture here. You shift the temperature, make a temperature shift here very fast. And then you take a little sample out. And then you analyze it. You kill the bacteria and see what happened. Actually, you analyze it. Notice you measure a rate, so it's somewhat advanced measurement is here, because you are, what Steen and Arnvi did was that they took this bacteria, then they put it into radioactive methionine for 30 seconds. The bacteria likes radioactive methionine. It's an amino acid that's difficult to make. So it eats it all up. And all proteins that's made in this little interval is incorporated radioactive methionine. And after the 30 seconds, you overkill it, you put it again, very much more non-radioactive methionine. So everything that happened after the 30 seconds does not have any radioactive methionine. So you get all the thing that's produced, all proteins that's produced in this 30 seconds have radioactive methionine. And then you just measure that. And you measure it by Gale, the two-dimensional Gale electrophoresis, pick out the DNA K on after this protein and count how many there is. And what you see is something like this here, upper curve. So this is the classical heat shock. The rate of DNA K at time zero is, well, we put that to one, and then how it goes up as a function of time, this is in measured in some time units here, and then it has a peak, and then it falls down again to some other steady value, which is different from the beginning value. The height of this peak is the heat shock. You can also do the reversed experiment, which is reasonable to consider when you are a physicist. So here you go, instead of from 30 to 37, you go from 37 to 30, and you get a peak down. That's fine. Now you can do a whole series of experiments of this type, where you start at each experiment, you start at a different initial temperature. You always quench 7 degrees upwards. And actually, I'm not sure which. I think actually I have written the wrong thing up there. What I want to say. Yes. So I'm not sure which one is the right one actually. What the main point is here is that when you shift upwards and shift downwards, it really looks like it should. The signal is reversed. What is more interesting here is that if you always shift upwards, then when you shift upwards at 30 degrees or you shift upwards at 12 degrees, you get the opposite phenomenon. You get an inverse heat shock. When you shift from 12 to 19 degrees, you get a depletion in your production rate. Whereas from 30 to 37 degrees, you got an increase in your production rate. So it's opposite signal. So the heat shock is suddenly getting an anti-heat shock.
You
let it at 70 degrees. They're always at 37 at this point. The shift is taking place at zero. And this is a function of time. So there's something happening, and then something else is happening, and then the system settles to rest. Okay, now you take the height of this heat shock. The maximum height, take the logarithm, or just plot it here, logarithmic scale, is the maximum height, and plot it versus the initial temperature. And then you get this dot here, which is roughly a straight line. Test a little bit, and this here, this point here, for example, is the height there. So this height here is something like 7, and this here is something like 7. This is the height, this is this point up there, the maximum point up there. So it's a maximum response your system have sometimes it's negative, so the most extreme. It's a max of the absolute value, and then, yeah. Sometimes it's negative, which is meaning that here you have 1, and sometimes it actually go below. So it's kind of the extreme response we're interested in here. and that has a straight line. So that is essentially fitted. There is a little equation. It's fitted like a straight line. The logarithm of the response is linear in the temperature. Zero at T0. And you read off a slope. So this is the data point. This is this alpha. Now, of course, what does it mean? Well, we know essentially that R was a kind of rate of, it was a ratio of two rates. That means essentially it's, so the log of R would essentially be, a difference in free energy. Be more concise. If I now assume that DNA KDT is produced due to something taking place in the cell, it's a reasonable assumption. It essentially depends on the composition of the cell multiplied by the chemical reaction rates in the cell. When I make this quench, I don't really have time to change the composition of the cell. So what I'm actually seeing is the chemical reactions in the cell. Let me assume that for a moment, so we start up. It's not really true, but we can repair it later. Then you take the rate here, up here. The rate would then be the ratio of such two. That would be the chemical reaction at T plus delta T divided by the chemical reaction constant at T, at zero temperature. And that means that the log of R would be D log K dT, approximately equal that. And that was the one we saw was linear in T. That means that log of K is a constant times something which is a parabola, which means that K is a e to minus d. That means that the free energy is some d0 minus something which is a parabola going downwards. R was this ratio. R was the ratio. That was this plotted here, and that was the ratio of this point to this point. And at this point, you change your temperature from T to T plus delta T, and the system actually doesn't have time to respond yet. So you still have the old expression level. That's why it's reasonable. So, okay. We'll just take this here and plot it. Delta D versus T, that's this red curve with this alpha. And here is some typical proteins where you see the stability of proteins versus temperature. And you see that they are somehow scattered around. Typically, the most stable point is also around 20 degrees. And then they have some curvature which is very similar to that one. Might be off by 50%, which is very acceptable because I'm assuming a first order reaction. I have no idea about what order reaction I'm talking about. So essentially what we are seeing here is something that's completely compatible with the stability of proteins in the cell. And you can go a little bit, we can go one step deeper in this analysis. Essentially you could ask yourself how it could be that our signal actually, when we move from one temperature to another temperature, when we actually destabilize something, how can I then get a positive response? I was getting a positive response when I moved up there, get a negative there, I would get a positive if I moved that way. So that we can only do, we have to reverse a sign, so it has to be inhibitory. And heat shock is somewhat understood. At least there is some literature about it. And this is a subset of this literature. It's a kind of network of the one that we saw this morning. It's a completely different network, of course, but it's something taking place in the protein, in the cell. And what you're seeing here is that DNA K, the one we're looking at, is produced as consequence of some other subunit of something, of the RNA polymerase. And it's actually what we really monitor is the rate of production of that, and that is the free density of this unit, subunit. So that is what we actually measure in this signal. And what we are saying is that there's something inhibitory. The inhibitory thing is the binding of DNA K to sigma 32. So the most primitive model would be to say that this binding gets weaker. Then it gets more sigma 32, and then this gives you more DNA K. It's not the right model. The right model is somewhat more complicated. It's actually DNA K binding to the chaperone. It's a chaperone binding to unspecific proteins, and therefore freeing its binding there, then giving more sigma 32, and then giving this one over there. And that you can actually somehow write down in equations, and you can get some kind of heat shock, which is somewhat believable up to somehow this point, maybe a little bit further. But this is a very simplified model of a heat shock because it ignores all the other lines you could draw in this diagram. There's supposed lines from here to here, and I don't know, there's other lines that's possible. Okay, so let me summarize kind of thing here. So we have the DNA K rate. This was a signal. And what we saw was that the height of this peak was essentially reflecting the stability of the protein. That's kind of nice. Then there's a second piece of data. So that means essentially that this transient behavior of the system reflects the stability of the proteins. There's another set of data in the literature that is actually the level, the steady state level of the DNA K. And the steady state as function of temperature, that looks something like this here. It's slowly raising, and then it takes off, essentially exponentially or very fast at this point. So it raised from 4,000 to 6,000 at 37 degrees. At 42 degrees, it's 9,000. At 46 degrees, it's 18,000. This does not reflect the stability of the protein, but it could. This kind of thing could reflect that folding is suddenly getting much more complicated. So somehow some vague speculation that this here might be the kinetic thing, kinetic transition. Okay, let me stop here. Yeah? Yes, absolutely, yes. So this here was what we look at in the last part of the talk. No, so the water, yes, so this maximum of stability here, this feature it has a maximum has to do with water. That is a cold unfolding, and that has to do with that at this point, the it begins to be important that the entropy of the water gets less and less important at this when you go down here.
So at very low temperature, water is in its sort of low state.
It's in a low state, yes.
And as you increase the temperature, the intermediate range, water, according to the model, that you have sort of a self.
It won't. The water would like to gain all the entropy it can gain. By putting the protein together. Yes. Absolutely, yes.
This model water, I'm sure many people have studied water, is that a reasonable limit?
I would say that it's a very coarse-grained physics. it's not telling you anything about the structure of the water. But it's
coming from the internal
equilibrium of water. It comes from, yeah. Yes, so this different states of the water should reflect the different states that when you heat water, it has a constant heat capacity. That means that when you can actually pump in energy into it at a constant rate at any temperature. So that is kind of making a ladder. Well, it's up to it. It boils essentially. Up to the heat. And then what? But at some point, of course, this well, the correlation length of water gets so small that you don't, if there's no correlation between the water and the next water layer, then there's no real entropy anymore then the hydrophobic forces will somehow, this hydrophobic entropy contribution will disappear. But that's very high up.
I guess this is what I'm asking, the microscopic origin of
this ladle? No, but it's kind of, it's
a,
it's we just took it from when you heat up water, it's really constant. That is constant. You would get a constant one if you took the Dulong-Petit law, I think, or what's called this the heat capacity is kind of a constant in this type of models.
Yeah, but that's much bigger than
that. Yeah. Yeah, that's, yes, yes. So I guess the right answer is that it's not understood. So what? Okay. So it's so I think I don't know. I don't know how to describe in a better, more detailed level.